Hi, this is Misha Tate, and you're listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Stitch Duran, and you're listening to Carson's Corner. Make sure you stay tuned in.
This is Justin Ray Harvey, Frank Duke's student. You're listening to the best of the best shows on the web and beyond. Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
This is Bo, the one-man army Taylor, media darling and Midwest champion of the world. You're listening to the only radio show that's hard-hitting, keeps it real, and does not pull punches. Carson's Corner.
This is the coach, Sean Tompkins, and you're listening to the best in mixed martial arts, Carson's Corner.
Okay, let's go. Yeah, g'day, this is Justin Lawrence calling from my backyard in Australia, mate. You're listening to Bob Carson, the finest investigative journalist in mixed martial arts history. Listen to his show, I love it.
Hey, this is Joey Odessa, and you're listening to me on the Bob Carson Show, the show that lets no words barred give a whole new perspective to no holds barred.
These days, it's not much fun at Bally's and Caesars in Atlantic City. The CEO is playing the corporate greed game, cutting dealers' hours, cutting retirement and health benefits, even breaking the law by refusing to bargain. Yet he paid himself $39 million last year, with plenty of perks.
Place your bets.
When Bally's and Caesars play games with casino dealers, it's not fun for anybody. And everybody loses. That's why the UAW Atlantic City Dealers Union paid for this time.
Welcome to Carson's Corner, folks. I'm your host, Bob Carson. This is September 11th, 2011. Like most other people in my position today, I'd like to take a moment to remember the victims of 9/11 and their families. Obviously, this date marks one of our greatest national tragedies and something which will live in history as a terrible act of murder and a crime against humanity. Our thoughts and condolences go out to everyone who lost friends or loved ones on that day. This event is something which touched the MMA community like every other. Remember that event? I think it was Pride 16 that happened shortly after the attacks. The fighters involved were visibly shaken and moved, but they put on a great event anyway, even by the high standards of Pride shows at times. Guy Mezger is one individual, just off the top of my head, who I know lost someone close to him on that day, yet he came out and put on a career performance against Ricardo Arona. Guy should have won that fight, but the important thing was that he came out and fought his ass off despite the circumstances. He pulled it together and went on. That's great fortitude. That's sort of how I feel about the United States sometimes. I think that the people of this country held it together okay despite our deep divisions and disagreements. Our leaders may be a different story, but that's for another show, folks. Right now, I just want to mark the occasion. It seemed like the right thing to do. I did this on my political show as well. Just one more thing before we head on to what we've got going on today. While we remember the victims of that day who didn't survive, let's be sure we don't forget the survivors. Our treatment of those suffering from 9/11-related illnesses due to their presence and often their heroism at the Ground Zero site has simply been shameful. We need to do the right thing by these people. We need to set some money aside so that these people can get what they need in the way of medical treatment and support. If we don't take care of the surviving first responders and victims of the attack, what does it say about us as a country? That would be the real shame of 9/11 if we left behind the people who refused to leave others. It's not a political issue. It's an issue of human decency. The 9/11 responders should be a priority, period. All right, that's enough about the date. Let's carry on as normal and get back to the almost shockingly good episode of the show we have for you today. First, we've got MMA fighter and former WEC champion Brock Larson. Larson was incredibly dominant at one point, but now after a couple of recent setbacks and a recent shocking 7-second KO, He stands at a career crossroads. I want to play you that interview. Thank you very much to Brock Lesnar, who was very appreciative of the interview. In fact, he wrote on his Facebook page that this is a very hard interview for him, and he had a good time while doing it. And I want to thank you, Brock, for coming on the show. Very, very easy to deal with, and a very, very fun interview for us as well. And that's what we're going to have going on for you today. But first, we also have on the show National Treasurer and International Ambassador for the Martial Arts and Personal Discipline, Mr. Frank Dukes. This is going to be a ridiculously packed show. Frank has got a lot going on. It's been a while since we talked to him, and we're proud to have him back on the show here for you today. So we're going to play the Brock Larson interview first, and then from there we're going to be going to Frank Dukes. Thank you very much to everybody. And we'll talk a little about some boxing afterwards. Of course, last night was the Strikeforce card. I'll give my thoughts on some of that. Some shocking fights. I mean, Daniel Cormier, wow. I think he's going to win the tournament. I really do. But we'll talk about that after our Frank Dukes interview. But first, as I said, here is Brock Larson right here on Carson's Corner. Ladies and gentlemen, Brock Larson is well known to MMA fans as the incredibly dominant former WEC champion with victories over seven UFC veterans. After a shocking upset defeat against Eric Davila, Brock joins us to talk about his extensive career to date and his future in the era of mainstream cage fighting. Brock, it's great to have you on the show today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
You're from Brainerd, Minnesota, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
Is it exactly the way it was depicted in the entirely true 1996 movie Fargo? Just kidding, of course.
Right. No, it's a little different. It's quite a bit different, actually. No, Fargo is quite the movie. I get quite a few questions actually regarding Fargo. We're pretty normal. We're not quite all that loopy.
Yeah, I know. It's like, the movie has done a lot of damage to Brainerd's reputation, I think, internationally.
Right, yes.
It's also one of several places which claims to be the birthplace of the historical figure Paul Bunyan, the real giant whose existence has been thoroughly documented. Where do you stand on the Bunyan birthplace issue?
Well, it's definitely where he was born.
Absolutely.
I mean, where else would he be born?
Do you
there's no question.
Now, I'm done joking about Brainerd. Let's talk more seriously about your MMA career, because you've had some great moments and great fights, Brock. Do you feel at all like you're at a career crossroads right now?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I think, you know, coming off that ridiculous loss that, you know, I just came off of when I was, in my mind, a favorite. You know, it makes you think a little bit of what you're going to do and kind of falling short. You know, I think, personally, I think I'm a lot better than I was 2 years ago, 3 years ago, technically. As we can see, something faltered. So mentally or physically, I'm not quite sure yet. I'm definitely, you know, going down that road and thinking, taking some options and thinking about what I'm going to do. You know, I'm for sure going to take another fight see how that goes. I mean, a seven-second fight, it's hard to rush your career on whether or not that was what's more to come or if it was just a fluke. You know, I like to think that it was a fluke a little bit. I mean, I don't believe in lucky punches because, of course, they're trying to hit you and they hit you. I'm not done by any means, but these next few fights will be critical in making that decision.
Are you at a point where up to this date you've considered changing your approach to fighting, training, or both?
Well, you know, I have. Actually, I have changed my a little bit, and I don't know, you know, that could be, I mean, I've been out to Seattle and I've trained with Matt Hume and been in camps with Rich Franklin and been down to Brazil and trained with Nogueiras, and you know, I've been all over training, and now I'm just, you know, trying to get comfortable at home and got two gyms that I'm training at that I run and own. So all that stuff is all new to me and trying to get acclimated with that. So I think, yeah, my training has changed a bit in the last year. And so I'm just trying to figure everything out, balance everything out, you know, and that and have three kids and a wife is, it's all a balancing act. So that's kind of, that's the battle. That's the battle right there.
Is there any element of burnout in some of your more recent fights? The Villa matchup may have been too short to tell, but against Safadine, I thought you looked flat compared to some of your past performances.
Yeah, that fight, clearly, I think I overtrained for the Safadine fight. Got in there, and I felt real weak once I was trying to do stuff and just couldn't get going. Kept telling myself to fire, and I just couldn't take off. That was, I put a lot of pressure on myself for that fight, you know, try to get back on top, and I trained super hard for that fight, and I think that was a classic overtraining. That's because, I mean, everything I did was right. I pushed him in the fence. I did my game plan, but I just couldn't execute a lot of the stuff that normally is pretty much a go.
Yeah, and the reason why I asked that is because a lot of fans have been speculating about why you've had some ups and downs as an athlete in the last year and a half or so. It's not that you don't have the skills to compete at the top level, because you've shown that you can hang with the best, and it's not like you're out there getting clipped and KO'd multiple times. Are your losses related at all, or are fans just looking for a narrative that isn't there?
You know, it's hard to say. You know, a couple of different situations, you know. With the Safadine fight, I mean, like I said, I'm pretty sure I'm chalking that one up to overtraining. Because just when I got in there, I didn't feel like myself. Felt cloudy. And then the last fight, it was just really, like we said, just too short to tell what was going on. I felt really good going into that fight. Unfortunately, it didn't turn out quite how I wanted to. And in the UFC fights, the two that I lost back to back, those ones, it was really just a matter of burnout, absolutely. I just was fighting quite a bit. I always called me on short notice, and I always took the fights and didn't think much of it, and cutting a lot of weight for a lot of the fights, and back to back, cutting weight like that just, I think, burnt me out mentally, and you know, I didn't have that, I had the tiger, so to speak, mentality going in there. It was just, I kind of was like, okay, it's a little work. And just didn't have the, you know, the drive that you need to be, because everybody's got that. And if you don't have that, that's an edge in favor of your opponent. So, but that aside, I think, you know, it's for sure. I mean, a lot of the stuff that I'm doing is better, I think, now. Just taking my time. I'm not training. Well, this last fight, I think I had a great training camp for. I trained smart, you know, a little different, didn't kill myself, and my weight was phenomenal. I got a good nutrition now, and so I don't have to kill myself to get down to weight, and everything was falling into place, and I had good feeling about that fight, but unfortunately, it didn't happen, so.
Let's talk about the Davila fight specifically, because I think a lot of fans were absolutely shocked to see a fight of yours turn out that way. I should mention up front that Davila was always talked about as one of the most underrated fighters on the scene, especially in Texas, and that was before he fought you and Pete Spratt. This guy is a good guy, way better than his record, but I don't think anybody expected it to be over that quickly either way. Can you take us through the fight against Davila and what happened?
Yeah, well, you know, we got in the cage. Big John asked me if I was ready. I said, absolutely. And, you know, I was fell victim to maybe study and fight too much. That's another thing that I never used to do, and I'm going to kind of go back to that, as not studying film too much, because I always seen all of his fights, and he always came out, he led with the hook and came with the big cross. And I was actually looking for the hook. I was waiting for him to throw the cross, and my plan was to shoot underneath and go for the takedown off his cross. And he came out and threw two crosses back to back and caught me with the second one. And then Big John was trying to pass my guard, you know?
Did his knee hit your head at all?
No, it was just the second cross is what landed. It's the first one surprised me, and I backed up, and up came my chin, and second one came over to the top, and that was when lights went out. So.
Yeah, I mean, I saw it on a low quality video, and you know, it looked like his knee may have hit your head, but I don't know, because you know, we don't try to tarnish somebody's win, but we've seen one or two guys get tagged by a knee accidentally on the way down, and that could sometimes play a role in the fighters, you know, if they're knocked out or not, you know, if they get hit with a knee on the way down, it could be bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's another here or there. I mean, it was the cross that hurt me, that put me down, and whether the knee lands or not, that's not the issue. The issue was the straight right that, or the over the top right that hurt me, you know.
Now let me ask you: getting caught with a punch extremely early like that, is it more frustrating to lose that way than it is to lose in a back and forth fight?
It's more embarrassing than anything, you know. I mean, I actually, after that loss, after the embarrassment was done, it was kind of one of those things where you just kind of shake your head at it and just kind of say, well, you know, the first time I've ever been knocked out in my life, never sparring, never in a fight, first time that's ever happened. So that was all new experience for me. And so I just kind of shook that one off and thought, that's not ever going to happen again. Be, you know, more prepared for such things.
You went through a period of being very dominant, as I alluded to in the intro, in the WEC organization, in your first couple of UFC fights as well. After that, you had two back-to-back losses. At any point, did you feel like you had lost your rhythm or mojo as a fighter? Do any events or outcomes stand out as particularly negative?
Yeah, you know, well, you know, coming off the pile win, got the submission of the night, and I was feeling pretty good about myself and really confident. And I asked for a couple big fights. I asked for a certain matchups about big names, and I figured I had deserved that. It just never came. I kept on fighting the new guys, you know. And I mean, if you look at the UFC, the fights that I did there, they're all fairly new guys and no names. I mean, Foster was the most experienced out of all the guys that I had fought in the UFC, and I wanted a name. I wanted something. And unfortunately, you know, I kind of got, maybe it was cocky, maybe it was discouraged, maybe I was overconfident because I didn't know the people. You know, when I fought Pierce, I mean, he was, in my opinion, was just another wrestler. And just kind of was bummed out that I didn't get a big name fight that I was asking for, you know. And just kind of like, okay, well, here we go. Let's go beat this guy up and see what's next. I kind of looked, you know, past him. So I think in my head, I kind of was a little discouraged and kind of frustrated, and in a way kind of overlooked the next two opponents in a weird kind of way. I know an athlete shouldn't think like that, and you try to make yourself respect and be up for every fight, but I think hindsight, I'm pretty sure that I was a little bit frustrated.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you if there's – you kind of answered this already, if there was something which clicked during your WEC run that you lost touch with when you lost in the UFC. But it just seems that it was just maybe a little bit of overconfidence on your part, and maybe, you know, taking on too much at once. Is there any sort of psychological confidence factor at work when you fight? I mean, I must admit that I think anyone who fights in the ring faces a huge psychological pressure. But my impression when I recall your fights is that you seem to be the best when you start quickly and take control. Would you agree with that, or do you have any other thoughts on coming out quickly and trying to impose your will versus maybe holding back and feeling out of the opponent for counter opportunities?
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head there. I mean, I'm a fast starter, and I'm aggressive, and I bring pressure, and I try to break people with that pressure. And I kind of, in a way, as I got better with stuff, I kind of turned into the prototype fighter, where you're going to, you know, wait for the opportunity to open up and exploit that weakness and go after it instead of creating my destiny and creating the weakness and creating the holes to attack. So actually, with the Davila fight, I kind of was going to change. I was going to be more aggressive. That's like I said, I'm going to wait for him to throw the hook, the cross, shoot, drive, pressure, throw whatever I got to throw in between there. And my plan was to get back to just overwhelming people and being super aggressive. And unfortunately, we didn't get to see that.
I think when I saw your fight against that guy, I forget his name, that it looked like you literally killed him. You would have killed him if the referee hadn't stopped you. I think his first name was Kevin.
Kanajian.
Yeah. Did that sort of effective aggression come from somewhere within you psychologically, or is it finishing people quickly something that you developed in training?
Well, that's something, I mean, an early go, I started doing that. Just because back in the day, there was tournaments, and when you'd fight, you'd want to be aggressive, get it done so you didn't take a lot of damage and you weren't tired from a 15-minute fight. So in a weird sort of way, I think that, because in Minnesota we weren't commissioned, and we just kind of did our own thing, and in some casino shows, fighting in tournaments, you know, we just go. And if you prolong the win and eke out a win, going to make for a long tournament. So I think fighting in that tournament setting where it was more pressure to just get in and get out, I think actually helped me, and I think I really got to get back to that if I'm going to continue to fight.
On a personal level, what sort of feeling is it when you go out and ragdoll someone around like that and utterly dominate them? Are you someone who particularly enjoys hitting and finishing people, maybe more so than is normal at times?
Yeah, I think most guys do. I mean, I think when I go out there and you completely dominate a fight, and there's no doubt in anybody's mind that you were the best fighter in that cage at that time and the most dominant athlete at that moment. I think, you know, leaving no question to who the better fighter was, I think that's really, you know, is a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when you fought Safadin and guys like that, they spent a lot of time basically trying to shut you down rather than attacking you as hard as they could. And that must have been frustrating from your standpoint, you know, because it's not the type of the fight that you want, although you have to adjust and you have to, you know, that's part of the fight game. But
yeah, with the Safadin deal, that was a 36-foot cage, and there was a lot of room to run in that thing. I mean, you could run forever in that cage. And that's always frustrating. I think for anybody who wants to get it going and wants to fight, and you get a guy that just kind of wants to circle out and kind of counterpunch, and it's like, let's just get dirty. I mean, Safadin's a phenomenal fighter, and he did what he had to do, and he did a good job, took me out of my game plan. He switched his leads a couple times, and that kind of threw me off too. So he just did a really good job of, I think, game planning and putting some good things together.
Can you learn any lessons other than keep your hands up early from the Davila fight?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I just got to start faster, you know, not going to wait anymore. I'm not going to wait for a counter. I'm not going to wait for the hook. I'm not going to wait for the cross. I think got to get back to attacking. And if I get clipped on the way in, I mean, that was always my fear with my style being aggressive, that when when I come in worried about getting clipped. But as we know, you can get clipped pretty much anywhere, anytime. So other than waiting for the opportunity to happen, just going to clear it myself, make the opportunity happen with pressure and get after it, get aggressive. I mean, I think being aggressive and, of course, keeping the chin down and hands up are always good. But if you're firing at somebody, they're less apt to you know, be aggressive back. So they're countering. That's a good thing, in my opinion.
What are your plans from this point looking forward? Should we expect to see you fighting somewhere again soon? Do you have any matchups lined up that we can disclose here?
Well, you know, I am looking at taking a fight at a casino in South Dakota. They just asked me if I'd be willing to do that. And I can't, unfortunately, remember the casino's name. But it'll be in South Dakota for Chris Christensen, be the main event. It was going to be Matt Delanoite for their title, but he had a prior obligation. So they're currently looking for an opponent for me that'll take it for whatever they may need. I don't know what they're paying. I don't really know anything like that. So, but yeah, they're looking for an opponent now. So hopefully we got some takers and got a good opponent, and we'll be able to go for broke.
You know, from a matchmaking point of view, I don't think the Davila fight can set you back that far, since all it really showed is that he hits really hard. Dana White and Zuffa are being open about their need to sign fighters for all the shows they put on and they want to put on. I really feel like you should have a place on the roster of one of the major shows. You have an entertaining fight style almost all the time. You've beaten tons of UFC-level guys, and the fans seem to respond to you. I think it's important to note, most of our audience is already probably aware of this, but even despite recent setbacks, you're still something like 7-4 overall against UFC veterans. You've got a long resume of very tough opponents. I also think that you have quite a memorable look as a fighter. Have you ever considered possibly trying your hand at something like acting or anything with regards to that?
Oh, my. No, not really. I haven't really thought about it. If the opportunity came, I'd absolutely try it. I'm no Rich Franklin by any means,
right.
But no, I mean, that would be something that would be fun. I mean, anything, you know, would be fun. I always like challenges, and if something like that came up, absolutely, I would go for it, because it's a tough job, and I think that'd be entertaining to see that end of the business.
I was in the movies last night. I went to go see this new Warrior film. And during one of the coming attractions, they have this movie. I forget what it's called. But Gina Carano was the star in this film. She's starring in a film with Michael Douglas and some other big-name Hollywood actors. And I think that's amazing to see, you know, MMA fighters really gain that much notoriety to the point where they're put in a film with someone like Michael Douglas. I mean, we've seen Rampage star in major Hollywood productions. We've seen other fighters, Randy Couture and The Expendables. So, you know, it's entirely possible. As this sport grows, I think that opportunities along those lines are going to be presented to fighters, really, and, you know, a lot of MMA fighters.
Yeah, I think that's a good opportunity for a lot of the guys to take advantage of. I mean, I wouldn't mind dipping my hand in and see how it works. I mean, I don't know if I'm an actor or not, but I could try it and figure it out, and then I would know.
Exactly. Here's a fun question out of left field. You faced Robert Filisco Muratic in what I think was a charity grappling match where you defeated him by third-round submission. I considered lasting to – I think Fearless Goat, he's quite a controversial character in the MMA community due to his arrest for sex offense. What's your impression of Fearless Goat as a grappler and a person, if you indeed remember who I'm talking about?
Yeah, if anybody seen that match, it was definitely a charity match because there was like I catch and released a lot on that match,
right.
And it was just something where, you know, it was fun. He asked me to do it, and I said, sure. You know, I mean, I didn't get paid for it. I didn't, nothing. It was just kind of one of those deals that I just said, yeah, let's do it, you know, and not really knowing any situations or anything like that. And so that's kind of the story on that one. But he's, you know, it was a good time. Anytime I get a chance to grapple, I'm going to do that. You know, I just got back from Naga and won the black belt division and won the expert division in that. So I enjoy grappling. So anytime I get a chance to showcase my skills there, I usually jump on the opportunities.
Well, you know, since it was a charity match and it was more lighthearted, wasn't as competitive. I would think that he wouldn't stack up well against people like Mike Pyle and Eric Apple, both jiu-jitsu practitioners who you've tapped out.
No, he would not. No, no, he would not stack up well against pretty much anybody at that level.
Well, thanks for the insight, because we had a guy on Bo One Man Army Taylor, and he really let Fearless Goat have it on the air here while he was on the show a couple years ago. I thought it would be good to get your perspective as a guy who faced him on the mat. It's been great to have you on the show today with me. I'm going to let you get back to your training and family commitments, but before I do, are there any websites or links or other projects you have going on that we should let our listeners know about?
Oh, man, I got all kinds of them. Production, I got my own fight company. It's CFX Promotions. I got that going on. That's at CFX Promotions, and I'm just opening up a new gym. It's going to be a Get Some gym with Get Some Athletics. But that you can find at Warriors Alliance or GetSome.com. So,
are you on Facebook?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm going to try to friend you on Facebook and folks, I'm on Twitter as well, twitter.com/BobCarsonMMA. I'm going to try to hook up with Brock on Facebook so you can friend both of us on Facebook, unless you have something like 5,000 friends or something.
Well,
I've got
a couple different ones. My personal one, I don't have that many. But, yeah, friend me. We'll be friends. I was looking for more friends. Everybody needs friends.
That's right, brother. Thank you very much, Brock, and best of luck in the future.
All right, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Bye-bye. The legendary Frank Dukes is back with us here on Carson's Corner, and this may be the first edition of Carson's Corner that is featured on Cage Junkies Radio Network. It's going to expose us to a whole new audience, so to speak. It's been a while since we had Frank on. I think the last time we had Frank on was, I want to say, in April earlier this year when we had Doc Cinda. We had Sky Benson, and, of course, we had Justin Ray Harvey on the show to talk about the Black Dragon Society and more. Frank, as usual, has a lot going on. He's one of the most busy men I've known in my life, and he's got a lot going on, and he's got a lot to talk about, as usual. Frank, how are you?
I'm doing great, Bob. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. It's a little rainy over here on the East Coast. You know, we've had a rough patch of weather recently, but you know, I'm doing okay. I'm alive. That's all I can ask for. What do you got going on, Frank?
Well, a lot. I was just, I starting a column on USA Dojo or founder Dana Stamos on Wide World. I think it's called WorldwideDojo.com. And what it is a column called Debunking the Debunkers. And it's a place where we're going to actually present balanced reporting about all facts in martial arts, the real histories of things that happened. And everything's not open to spin, speculation, and hearsay. And the next one I'm going to be doing is a thing called Legends and Legacies, where it's an actual video interviews that I conducted. Like, I just conducted one with Cynthia Rothrock, in which we give them the opportunity to tell their story, and we learn things about them that might otherwise, you know, not make the pages of a magazine, and that is inspirational and is a tribute to their legacy.
Well, I mean, it sounds like the Legends and Legacies, is this going to be in podcast form or is this going to be in written form? Because I know that for a while you and Gordon were talking about doing some sort of podcast show on that.
No, this is actual video, and we're hoping that it will get picked up, and we can even turn it into a television series someday here real soon.
When is that set to kick off?
Well, we actually have, I believe, some stuff up right now. And, in fact, some of the things that we're doing is called A Message in a Bottle, where different martial art greats are actually leaving their philosophy behind for future generations. One was just done with Jun Rhee, myself, Benny Yukitas, just to name a couple.
Now, Frank, I mean, you're a guy that, of course, is used to a lot of people coming after you, a lot of people making claims, and a lot of people looking to discredit you. I really haven't been paying attention to certain blogs out there, but can you give us an update on anything as far as your detractors? Any new guys come out of the woodwork, so to speak?
Well, they've kind of backed off because I actually, you know, for many years, I never had the opportunity to be able to respond. There was no way to respond. You had the magazines, which were controlled by a small group of individuals, and they control the majority of the market. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then you have, all sorts of conflicts of interest going on, and combined with a racist agenda.
Right.
That even Cynthia Rothrock spoke about in my interview with her in Legends of Legacy, where she was told women and minorities are not featured on the cover of Karate Illustrated by its editor. So there's many, many things to take into consideration when you're with what we're talking about here. You know what I mean?
That's right.
And so for years, people heard all these rumors about myself and about other people without ever having any opportunity to be able to say, hey, that's not true. I mean, a good example is it crossed over into mainstream media. You have like a kind of a crooked, I believe, unethical journalist by the name of John Johnson for the LA Times who wrote a complete hatchet job on me. I mean, the malice and the venom that comes through his tone in the way he describes me in his article is overt. There's nothing sublime about it. And he cites so-called evidence that people convicted me by, like saying I bought my trophy from a trophy shop near my home. Well, unfortunately, it took 10 years of litigation before I could actually get the evidence into a court of law and had the opportunity to show that it was totally fabricated and on its face fraudulent. I mean, the so-called receipt wasn't even spelled my name right. It was spelled D-U-K-E-S. My name spelled D-U-X. And so just to give you an idea of what, you know, I was up against. In addition to the fact it was for the wrong year, and by the way, in addition to the fact that if you look at the description of the trophy in his receipt, it isn't even for the same trophy. I mean, it was blatantly obvious.
Right.
And, you know, they say, oh, there's no one who ever fought me that they know of. Well, Vic Morris came out and talked about it. Vic Morris fought them all. He beat Chuck Norris, Bruce Lee, Joe Louis, Mike Stone, Mike Foster. Guy was USK karate champion, the first black karate champion. You never hear about him because, of course, he was a minority. And minorities, of course, didn't make the magazines or their accomplishments weren't allowed to dwarf those of others. And he spoke out. And there was, you know, Dr. Day of the Black Dragon Fighting Society. He's one of the patriarchs of it. All you had to do is pick up the phone and call him. Black Belt Magazine did an article in 1976. And in it, I think it was with John Keehan, and Keehan is talking about the Kumite fight, so he participated in the 60s. And in fact, to give you an idea how absurd their statements are, if you really do their research, they were public. They were held in Chicago. One was held in the University of Chicago in 1963. Unfortunately, movie makers, you know, hyped a lot of stuff, secret underground fights, death matches, and all that garbage. And I'm not in control of what the, you know, obviously what's being said by the media arm of a film company, but I paid the price for it. Everybody accused me of puffing or misrepresenting myself, which wasn't true. And, of course, it benefited those who were my competitors at the time, who are claiming that they're the one and only ninja masters in the world. And we know today that that's ludicrous. You have in Japan, Junichi Kawakami, who's a curator at the Ninja Museum in Japan, who is officially recognized by the government there. And he's one of many others who have a long lineage and history of teaching the art, and whose family is connected through generations of teaching the art. And so the absurdities, for some odd reason, became truths, because it goes right along with the old saying, you know, you tell a lie long enough and often enough, and people don't hear a challenge, it becomes a truth. And that's why I founded Legends and Legacies, and I founded you know, Debunking the Bunkers, because it's an opportunity to really call on the mat for everybody to see the so-called evidence, the so-called allegations. And when you really get down to it and you start to realize it was nothing but spin, speculation, and hearsay, that's how I think we restore order to the martial art industry and put integrity back in it. And that's what my real goal is, and I'm hoping that will be my legacy, not blood sport, and not that I won all these championships, but I really had a love for people, a love for the arts, and I tried to restore order and truth and integrity back into it. What made martial arts what it is, and why people seek it out and want it.
Now, speaking of Bloodsport, isn't there a gentleman now that is claiming that movie was indeed about him?
Yeah, if you go to usadojo.com, I just saw it today. There's Jerry Bell, who's a martial artist, who's been running around Hollywood saying, I stole Bloodsport for him, that it was really based on him, that he won it. If you read his bio on USA Dojo, he won it in 1987. Unfortunately for Jerry, while the movie was released in 1988, we began principal photography in 1986. The script was written in 1985. And if you go even further back to the pages of Black Magazine, November 1980, I talked about the Kumite then. So how could I rip him off? It's just a ludicrous lie. And again, it's one of those myths that have been circulated, been allowed to go around, because no one like myself is, you know, given the opportunity to respond to them.
Now, this publication that this gentleman, Mr. Bell, works for, you're going to be writing for USA Dojo. You're going to be writing for them as well?
Yes. And I mean, one of the things, reason it came about is because Dana Stamos, who runs the website, she is a really, I think, integrous person. She's coming from a point of view. She just wants to know the truth. She got caught up in a situation where someone was being wrongly accused. And when she started to see the effects of that, and she was able to, you know, influence the outcome so that it was just, things were going to get steamrolled, and a person was going to be unjustly damaged by it, it renewed her spirit in the way she talked to me, and it gave her a sense of purpose. And so that's what she's doing with her website. It's one of the things she's doing, with her websites, which is, and she owns like 18, literally 18 websites, but they're all interconnected. And they've overtaken, by the way, I want to make something clear. They have a larger readership than Black Belt Magazine. So,
oh, really?
Contrary to what some people may think.
Yeah, I see. I mean, there was some talk about you publishing an article for Black Belt Magazine. I mean, it was off again and on again. What was the last thing that you published for Black Belt Magazine?
Oh, the only last thing that was published, I mean, in Black Belt Magazine was the November 1980 issue, when I retired from no holds barred fighting, and they asked me for an interview. I didn't even seek an interview from them. They came to me, and I gave them an interview regarding Kumite fighting, the no holds barred fighting that John Keehan is the guy who actually made famous, like I said, in the 70s and the 60s. But it was overtaken by Professional Kickboxing and Sport Karate Association. And when you really look at it standing back, it's really kind of fascinating because you had literally these two camps. You had the camps that are more traditional karate and they're more sport fighting, and then they wanted to take the sport fighting and make it more like boxing. And there was no grappling, of course, involved. And then you have the other camp, which is more like jiu-jitsu, judo, and of course that's very much grappling and integrated punching into it. Well, they got squeezed out by the athletic commissions in the early 70s because they were seen as being too violent. And, of course, the PKA got a foothold and did very well for a brief time. And then later, you have the MMA taking off, you know, with the emergence of blood sport. And that set the stage for the UFC.
Let me ask you, what about that documentary, Put Up Your Dukes? That was set to debut at, was it the Cannes Film Festival?
Yeah, they've got Shoreline Entertainment picked it up. They're responsible for marketing the film, and that's the most I know about it right now. I think they're planning on releasing it in Europe first and then bringing it to the United States. But it's an interesting glimpse. But in my opinion, it falls a little short because it really didn't tackle the issues. It just sort of danced around them.
This is a pretty critical view that they take of you. Like I've seen the trailer before.
Yeah.
I mean, at least it appears that way from watching the trailer.
Right. Yeah, and it is what it is. I mean, it's still, like I said, doesn't really tell my story, I feel,
right,
the way I'd like it to be told, and certainly leaves out, I think, are really key elements that could make it a lot more successful. But you hear from a lot of people that substantiate what I've been saying all along. You hear from Victor Moore, or you see that, us reunited after 35 years and how we broke out fighting and laughing about it. You hear from Dr. Day, who's actually there. Dr. Day, those people don't know, is Lawrence Day, who was actually, present when Jim Kosovic got killed in Chicago and during what they call the Karate Wars of the late 1960s. Admiral Smith, who's on camera talking about what I did for my country and how it's, it will always probably remain something that's not something I can go in great detail about, as well as other things that just basically corroborate everything I've been saying as being true. And, you wouldn't have that many people involved, and certainly when they have nothing to gain and everything to lose, stepping forward and talking about it, it wasn't the truth. I mean, it's just that simple. It shows you the kind of level of deceit practiced by these so-called websites like Bullshito. I mean, they ran around. They still to this day say I paid Billy Burke to give me an endorsement and use that to try to negate anything that everybody else is saying, like I paid for it, which is a complete, utter lie. Because I put out these Frank Dukes Kills the Bull videos, and in one of them you can see the actual photo release of Billy Burke saying that he didn't do it. And Billy Burke on camera says to people he didn't do it. And in emails he says he didn't do it. So,
Do you think there's ever going to come a point, Frank, where you say, I've done everything I could for the martial arts community. I've tried to be the best person I can be. People out there are just going to criticize me and and try to cast me in a certain light. And I mean, are you ever going to come to rest with the situation, Frank?
I think the only way it'll come to rest is when I'm dead, and just like it did with Bruce Lee. You know, I'm old enough to know and be around when Bruce Lee was alive. And he faced as much, if not more, controversy than myself. And everybody kind of forgets that and skirts it under the rug.
Right.
But when he died, all of a sudden he became this, you know, martial art god, if you will. He became the image to measure everybody by. And rightfully so, because what he was saying all along was the truth. He was a philosopher. He was trying to impart that we are more alike than we are different. If we just look at that and work together, and we can achieve whatever it is we all want. That was really the underlying message that Lee, I think, was trying to tell, that every martial arts master is trying to tell. Unfortunately, egos get in the way, personal agendas get in the way, and people who are on the peripheral who are not martial artists but are pretending to be or saying they are, they get in the way of it. They get in the way of the truth, and they basically corrupted our community. I mean, Bullshito Magazine or Bullshito, the website, is probably the worst offender. They promote nothing but hate, disrespect. You know, if a guy is not doing something right, I can understand that. Okay, bring it out. But they don't just do that. They resort to humiliation. They resort to speculation, spin, hearsay. They don't give people the opportunity to respond and not be obfuscated, not be drowned out, so what they're saying isn't heard. So, and when you look at it and you look at them, well, they're in the business of selling, you know, shirts, and they're in the business of selling martial arts gear, and they're in the business of, you know, tabloid reporting, and tabloid reporting creates controversy, and controversy sells. And the guys running it, they have no credentials. Chuck Hardin, who did the report on Billy Burke, and he has no verifiable or credentials to qualify him as an expert. And yet, you know, you heard him on your own show trying to pass himself off as an investigator, and Samuel Browning the same way. They're not investigators, not trained investigators. They don't know where to begin, and certainly they have an agenda. Investigator has to go into any investigation with an objective mindset, not trying to force a conclusion. Mm-hmm. And that is not what they're about. They're about forcing a conclusion that brings, you know, controversy to their site and brings, you know, hits to them. And from those hits, they make money. Bottom line, you know, period.
You're still teaching, Frank?
I do teach. In fact, most of my teaching, though, is reserved for law enforcement and the military. And the reason for it is I have, you know, I feel I'm way ahead of a lot of these so-called realistic self-defense programs that are out there. And they're, of course, marketing them to the masses. And the problem with that is their tactics, of course, are becoming recognizable in the hands of those people who they're going to be employed against. So I feel it's irresponsible for me to do that. That's why I've never, you know, done DVDs and tapes. And yet I'm the one who's being accused of being a commercial sellout. That's the irony of the whole situation.
Now, for our listeners, tell us where they can go to follow you. I know you have a bunch of different sites.
Well, the easiest one to start with is just go to frankwdukes.com, and that'll direct you to all sorts of information. And look for me on worldwidedojo.com and usadojo.com. Look for Legends and Legacies is the series that I've started, and soon to be released will be a series called Debunking the Debunkers.
Nice. Sounds good, Frank. Thanks a lot for coming on the show and updating us.
I got to apologize for my dogs in the background. They just, you know, we breed dogs to try to help the service industry, because we breed for a certain temperament and intelligence. And so they were good up until now. They didn't make any noise, but I got one here who's like a Houdini. He knows how to get in and out of doors and locks and just let himself in now, and I've got to let him out. So,
what kind of dog?
They're standard poodles. Hold on, buddy. Hold on 1 second, Bob. And I apologize again to your audience. I'm sure they're having a good laugh right now as I do this. There we go. Let them out. So they're kind of they're a trip. I had one dog to show you how smart this breed is, Bob. She knew you were supposed to eat out of the trash. She'd wait right for you to go to bed. She'd go into the kitchen with her mouth, open the door first to the kitchen. It was a sliding pocket door. Then she would go under the sink, open that door, take out the trash can, take out everything on top of the trash can that she didn't want, get what she wanted, put it on the side, take everything, put it back, put the trash can back under the sink, close the door, walk out to the dining room table, and she would eat underneath it whatever she wanted. It was just a trip.
Yeah, I know. My sister used to have a poodle, and she used to tell me all sorts of interesting stories about these dogs. Recently, they released a list of the top 10 most intelligent dogs, and I don't know. I know the poodle was definitely within the top 10. I don't know where they
I can tell you it's probably number two. But as forms of trainability, they're actually number one. But as far as intelligence, they're about number two. I think I'm trying to remember. It's a herding dog that actually is number one. I think it's an Australian Shepherd. I'm not sure, but on that. But poodles are definitely up there. And poodles are the only dog, just so you know, that you can drop in the desert and they will survive. That's how smart they are. They've done survival tests with them. So,
Frank, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for coming on the show, and a lot of people are going to appreciate hearing from you. And we'll talk to you sometime down the road.
Yeah, and I hope to talk to you guys about real martial art issues and things, not about this, you know, garbage that's been, you know, this hype and politics of martial arts. It's kind of mired the image of, you know, people being humble and without ego and not giving over to speaking gossip. So,
absolutely, Frank. Take care, buddy.
You got it. Bye-bye.
Thank you to both Brock and Frank Dukes for joining me. Brock is an intriguing character and an exciting fighter, so I hope to see him get back to his previous form. I think he enjoyed the interview, and I had a great time talking to him, as did Frank, too, as well. Frank is just always filled with passion and information. And, you know, one of the most telling parts of that Frank Duke interview is when I asked him, I said, Frank, when is this going to be over? At what point do you say, you know what, enough is enough? These people are always going to be critical of me, or some people are always going to be critical of me, and it's not worth driving up my blood pressure, and it's not worth, you know, potentially deteriorating my health. And what did he say in response? He said, it'll be over when he's dead. He will not let this go until he feels vindicated. He will not stop fighting the battle in his mind against people that are impure within the martial arts community. And that in itself, I think, is admirable. He compares himself to Bruce Lee in that regard, because Bruce Lee was a highly controversial figure, and the controversy never stopped. It never stopped. It only stopped for him when he was dead. And I think that was an interesting comparison. So thank you very much to Frank and Brock Larson. We had the Klitschko versus Adamek fight. Vitaly Klitschko destroyed Tomas Adamek over 10 rounds and looked absolutely unstoppable doing it. I saw this fight, which took place in Germany. And you know, there's not much to say about Vitaly's incredible combination. He's 40 years old. He uses the ring very, very well. His ring generalship is great, and I don't know if there's anybody out there that can beat him. Adamek showed a ton of heart. I didn't think he was going to last more than a couple rounds. You know, he didn't dance around like that coward David Haye did. Haye disgraced himself on the biggest possible stage. Adamek went out with his shield and tried to compensate for the mismatch, and you know, he went 10 rounds, and I've got to take your hat off to him. I don't know, you know, we'll see what happens in that division. There's
There's one potential opponent that Max Kellerman was talking about last night. The gentleman's name escapes me. To be honest with you, I don't follow boxing as closely as I do MMA. But, you know, perhaps that can be something we could see down the line, all right? And we had a huge night for MMA. We had the Strikeforce Grand Prix tournament last night, the semifinals of the Grand Prix tournament. And it was a pretty good show. I think I called it that Silva would have problems with Cormier. That's free advice from me from one of the best in the game. And I hope Cormier acted upon it. I think Cormier has a great shot against Barnett, who also looked good. I knew that Barnett was going to win via submission. Karatanov is more of a slightly red-nosed kickboxer at this stage, though. He's a very, very tough striker, very good striker. You know, he can knock you out, but his submission defense has always been questionable. Our friend Jeff Munson made him look like a white belt when they fought. And now, apparently, Jeff Munson is going to be fighting Fedor Emelianenko. We're going to try to get Jeff Munson back on the show here to talk about this incredible fight. Our last interview with Jeff Munson was incredible. Probably our most listened to interview of all time. All right, and Pat Healy continues his ascendancy at lightweight. I think that's very, very good. I text messaged Pat today. I haven't heard back from him, but he always responds back to me. One of the nicest guys. And I thought Blanco showed a little bit of classlessness when kicking Pat in the face and didn't even apologize for it. I'm kind of glad that Pat got that victory, not only because he's a friend of mine, but because I think Blanco didn't show any class during that fight. Healy is a hugely improved fighter. He's got a great work ethic. He reminds me of the Miller brothers, okay? You know, he has the body type that makes him look like a middleweight in the cage, and his wrestling and submissions are better than ever, and he's going to go a long way. He kind of, Lyle Bierbaum and this guy Blanco, in my opinion, seem to be a little bit kind of disrespectful towards Healy, and it's good to see one of the good guys in the sport win like that. King Mo, another former guest, KO'd Hodger Gracie, like so many others had planned to do before him. So congratulations to King Mo. That was a great, great shot that he landed behind the ear and threw off Hodger's equilibrium. And, you know, King Mo is right back there where he starts. He wants to fight Fei Zhao again. And, you know, I'm sure that if he were to fight Fei Zhao, that the result of the fight would tip in his favor. In fact, I would put money that King Mo would beat Fei Zhao again. So congratulations to him. A shout out to Billy D. Williams, Scott Farlam, and AMA. I want to wish Jimmy Miller of AMA congratulations. As I understand it, he had his first son, his first born child. Okay, at least he was supposed to have it Monday or Tuesday. I haven't heard any word about that, but I have to assume that, you know, he had the child. Congratulations to him. And if he didn't, well, you know, congratulations when it does occur. All right. So, I hope you enjoyed the show. Rockhold looked very, very good. Rockhold, you know, against, Jacare. What can you say? I mean, I don't think there was any doubt that Rockhold was winning that fight. Jacare could not get him on the ground. That fight was largely spent standing, and he looked like a strong, strong fighter, Rockhold. Okay, what do the rest of you think? Did you guys think that Luke Rockhold was going to beat Jacare? I was surprised, but I don't know. You know, you never really, really can tell. Okay, one thing's for sure: the MMA judging is looking good compared to boxing right now. Pat Miletich was making the point that he felt that Rockhold was ahead, during the fight, and there was no doubt that he was. And I don't think that the judges saw it the way Pat did. I mean, obviously they gave Rockhold the decision, but I think two judges had it 48-47, and they didn't have Rockhold winning all five rounds the way Pat Miletich did. And by the way, I tweeted this on my Twitter account that I thought that Pat Miletich was sort of bullying Frank Shamrock around last night. He kind of came across as a jerk a little bit. I don't know. Maybe that's just me, but some of the things he was saying was I don't know, I wouldn't say all unprofessional, but kind of arrogant, you know, a little bit bullying. Maybe we should ask Frank Shamrock if he thought that he was being verbally bullied by Pat Miletich, okay? I don't know. But going back to MMA judging, you know, they got it right. They've been doing better. The judges have been doing better. They're reforming the sport here. I've lost track of how many flagrant robberies we've had recently. Every week we're seeing someone get screwed by refereeing, judging, or some combination of the both. Great matchups in boxing right now are being ruined by the judging. It's a difficult time for many fans, although the in-ring action has possibly never been better. So many great fights, so many terrible decisions. That's the combat sports sometimes. So when judges get it right, we have to, you know, give them a tip of the hat. And last night, the judges, I felt, got it right during the Rockhold Jacare decision. One man that does not use combat for sport is Frank Dukes. Frank needs no introduction to our... Oh, I already did that. That's going to be it for this week's edition of Carson's Corner. Let me tell you what we got coming up for you soon. We're going to be interviewing Jay Pagliaro of Cage Radio's network. Okay, we're going to be actually working with Jay in the upcoming weeks. I'm going to be on his show. He's going to be on our show. Like I mentioned to you last week, Carson's Corner will be part of the Cage Junkies Radio Network. Very, very excited about that. It is going to expose us to a whole different audience. It's going to make us become part of a great website that is for and by the fighters and the fans. And that's very, very important. You know, you see a lot of people in this industry get behind the microphone or, you know, start typing on the keyboard. They may not have experience in MMA and you know, they may have their own personal agenda when it comes to what they're doing. They may be fans. They may be looking to get in the good graces of promotions and promoters. That's not the case with Cage Junkies Radio Network, okay? Jay Pagliaro and Heath Herring are two good guys, and they're two very, very opinionated guys, and I highly recommend that you listen to their show. I listened to their last show with Kevin Randleman, and it's really quality stuff. It really is. We're going to have Jay on the show later on in the week. We'll probably have another guest to go along with that. And, you know, just stay tuned for who it is, okay? You never know who's going to be on Carson's Corner. That's one of the great things about this show. Let me tell you how you could follow me. Just follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/BobCarsonMMA. Second to last, if you want to friend me on Facebook, just type in Bob Carson. If you're a fan of Brock Larson's, you can also friend me. I'm one of Brock's friends. He accepted my friend request yesterday, so you can friend me through Brock Larson. All right, but if you're not, if you're just listening to this show for the first time and you like what you hear and you want to follow me, just go on Facebook. Just type in Bob Carson and you'll see my profile. Lastly, if you're interested in politics, especially from a progressive point of view, I would encourage you to listen to my progressive podcast. I'm on a radio station here, a small radio station here in New Jersey, and I'm part of the Underground Progressive Radio Network. And you can follow my political show at bobcarson13.podomatic.com. That is bobcarson13.podomatic.com. We are the number one progressive podcast in America right now on Podomatic. And I want to thank each and every one of you for making that possible. Rest in peace to those who died. Thank you very much for your service and the first responders out there. Until next time, folks, show some respect.